وعلى آله وصحبه وبارك وسلم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. So we are looking at the fourth hadith of the 40 hadith collection of Imam Nawawi, rahimahullah. So if you want to pull it up on a phone, laptop, whatever you might have, this is narrated by the companion Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, radiallahu anhu, who we talked about last week a bit. And the hadith quite often is focused on concepts of embryology and fate. And so just while we're pulling it up, to recap, we started talking about it last week, and we got into a discussion on who Abdullah ibn Mas'ud is, companion of the Prophet of God, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. He was one of the first people to convert to Islam in the Meccan society. He came from a low social class. He was black. He was amongst those who were deeply persecuted in the early period of the Meccan society. He was the first person to publicly recite Quran in Mecca, and he had volunteered to do it in front of the Kaaba. He recited Surah Ar-Rahman, and they just started beating him while he was reciting. And people asked him, why would you do this? And he said, I would do it again if I needed to. Physically, he had a very kind of small physical stature. He was skinny, he was small. And there were people who would treat him poorly for all of these reasons, right? If you come on Wednesday to the Sira class that we do, you know, we talked about Meccan society and kind of how it's formulated, challenges in a very stratified society around race, class, gender, where lineage is very important, where you have no sense of accountability because the theology has no afterlife to it. So you just do whatever you want to if this is all that you got going on is in this world. And Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, he's like in the midst of all of this, right? We talked about also why it's important for us to recognize that the Prophet, peace be upon him, had senior companions who were black. And quite often we don't get taught this when we're learning the stories of the companions, or even in relation to this hadith that's talking about phases of embryology, it's talking about qadr, divine decree. You know, how does Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, being a young man who converts to Islam early on, faces this persecution, has parents who are stricken by poverty, he himself is black, comes from low-income background, and he's telling people this hadith that all of us are created from a similar beginning, and all of these things are decreed by God, right? And what does this mean when we're feeding into it now, recognition also of the person who's narrating the hadith and the words of the Prophet of God, and how it turns things upside down in a lot of different ways. Abdullah ibn Mas'ud is no joke as a person, right? He goes to Kufa. He is heavily influential of the development of the Hanafi school of thought. It's a major legal school within the four legal schools of Sunni Islam. The Prophet alayhi salam describes him as somebody that you should learn Quran from, you know, and he's a young black man who doesn't have a lot of money. And it's not taught to us always these things. And then we can't like understand necessarily also certain things that are important in terms of where and how Islam teaches us to have reverence and deference to people of all backgrounds. Because, you know, my family is from the Indian subcontinent. There's a good chance if you are from Pakistan in this room or like from that part of the world, that you practice Hanafi fiqh, right? They're not teaching people that one of the influencers of Hanafi fiqh in the Indian subcontinent, they're not teaching us that it was heavily influenced by a young black man in Pakistan. Like, you know, I can say this because I'm Pakistani, right? But like, they live in this world where it's all about kind of skin whitening cream, the realities of being colonized, where you seek validation from whiteness and supremacist systems. There's these kind of consequences, do you know? it permeates other cultures as well. But can you imagine how it would be different if in religious gatherings, people were teaching like these facets of religion also that are there, they're not made up, you know? Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, his students described him as being somebody who wears hair and braids. Do you know what I mean? Right? When you try to conceptualize a companion of the Prophet of God in your head, whatever you would think somebody who's living in Mecca or Medina looks like, does your mind conceptualize a black man with braids in his hair? You know? And he's one of the four people that the Prophet said to learn Quran from. Someone lost their phone. Is anybody losing their phone? Zoya is calling you right now. Does this look familiar? Anybody? Yeah.
Why is it there?
Why is it there?
It was found out there. It was found outside.
Oh, okay.
Is it yours?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't pick up when she called.
No, it's
up
front.
Oh, great.
Sorry about that.
I'm glad we found it under the So we want to think about this because Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, he doesn't also narrate thousands of hadith. He narrates like about 800, 900 hadith. You know, Quran is something he's more associated with. And it's not that like the companions narrated every single thing that they heard from the, like each companion doesn't say, here's every single thing that I heard from the Prophet of God. Do you know? So why are they continuing to pass on the things that they're passing on? It's not selective in those ways, but in being able to understand, like as we read through the text of this, what are we extrapolating from it? Okay, so just so we get into it, I don't know what's wrong with me. I think I'm getting sick. So just so you know, if things come out and they don't sound like they make sense, just tell me. My head's getting a little stuffy right now. I think I just need to get some like vitamin C. I was eating a lot of gross foods the last few days. And that's probably what it is. My body is reminding me I'm not 5 years old anymore. So can somebody read the hadith in English or in Arabic? It's the fourth hadith, Imam Nawawi's hadith in that collection. Does anyone have it?
Number four.
Hadith number four, right?
Deeds are by the final actions.
Yep.
On the authority of Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, may Allah be pleased with him, who said, the messenger of Allah, peace be upon him, and he is the truthful and the believed, narrated to us, verily the creation of each one of you is brought together in his mother's womb for 40 days in the form of a drop, then he becomes a clot of blood for a like period, then a morsel of flesh for like period, and then there is sent to him the angel who blows the breath of life into him, and who is commanded with four matters: to write down his substance, his lifespan, his actions, and whether he will be happy or unhappy, whether or not he will enter paradise. By Allah, other than whom there is no deity, verily one of you performs the actions of the people of paradise, until there is but an arm's length between him and it, and that which has been written overtakes him, and so he acts with actions of the people of the hellfire, and thus enters it. And verily one of you performs the actions of the people of hellfire until there is but an arm's length between him and it, and that which has been written overtakes him. And so he acts with the actions of the people of paradise, and thus he enters it. Bukhari and Muslim.
Great. Jazakallah khair. Does anybody want to read the Arabic? Yeah, go ahead.
Abdullah ibn Mas'ud radiallahu anhu, ربكم يجمع خلقه في بطن أمه 40 يوما نطفة ثم يكون علقة مثل ذلك ثم يكون مضغة مثل ذلك ثم يرسل إليه الملك فينفخ فيه الروح ويؤمر بأربعة كلمات بكسب رزقه وأجله وعمله وشقي أو سعيد فوالله الذي لا إله غيره إن أحدكم لا يعمل بعمل أهل الجنة حتى ما يكون بينه وبينها إلا ذراع فيسبق عليه الكتاب فيعمل بعمل أهل النار فيدخلها وإن أحدكم لا يعمل بعمل أهل النار حتى يكون بينه وبينها حتى ما يكون بينه وبينها إلا ذراع فيسبق عليه الكتاب فيعمل بعمل أهل الجنة فيدخلها رواه البخاري ومسلم.
جزاك الله خير. So just a couple of things, and as we go through this over the course of however many Mondays we stay with this text, you want to try to memorize parts of the hadith. The Prophet ﷺ is an amazing communicator. You know, his words are described as being jawami in nature, that they're not excessive or superfluous, but each word is something that has deep impact, concise statements. But also, in many of these hadith, what we're learning is actually like the exact words that the Prophet said. And there's barakah to this as well, and just engaging the hadith, reading from the hadith, and some of the etiquettes of it, similar to, you know, how we're taught Quranically to not be raising our voices in the presence of the Prophet of God, right? That we want to be in a place as hadith are narrated and read, we're just giving our attentiveness to them. You know, the way that you would kind of conceptualize or envision that the messenger is actually standing in front of you saying these things. What kind of deference would you be engaged in or kind of in your listening to this, right? So it's not just hearing, but actual active listening in that capacity. So today we want to kind of think about this hadith past the part where Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, he describes the Prophet ﷺ as being sadiq and masduq, right? The trustworthy one and the one who is trusted. So he spoke truth and people believed him. You know, and these are not like small things, right? We talked about this a lot in terms of character last week and even in reference to the world that surrounds us. Like literally all day we're bombarded by lies constantly. Like everybody's lying, you know? It's like to the point we're like, I don't even know who to believe anymore. And how much that creates chaos inside, that you walk into a space and it can be physical or virtual, and it's, I don't know if these people who, you know, are my friends, quote unquote, or my followers, or these things, that I, like, can trust them in what I'm about to say. What if I say this, and somebody does this? What if I say that? And you can imagine that people just found a sense of rest in the presence of the Messenger of God, alayhi salam, right? That they knew he was attentive, he was listening, but he wasn't just someone who spoke truth with his words. His actions, his demeanor, were reflective of what it was that he was espousing. Do you know? لِمَا تَقُولُوا مَا لَا تَفْعَلُونَ. You know, the Quran asks, why do you say that which you don't do? There's no application of this, right? And if you came on Wednesday to the Sira class, we're talking about the Prophet as a business person. And, oh, thanks, man. Why is everybody being so nice to me? Do I look miserable right now? Is that what it is? Yeah. Zakalakhir. You're in a place where, you know, we talked about last week in our Sira class, which isn't happening this Wednesday, by the way. The building's going to be closed. They changed the days that the building is open on Friday after we met last Wednesday. They're locking the building on Wednesday. Everybody's getting the day off at the university. But we talked about him being a business person and shifting into an entrepreneurial pursuit. And, you know, there's nothing without meaning in Allah's plan. So why is the Prophet being sent to Sham to do these trade routes and all of these other things? And people gave a lot of different answers that were all amazing. But we said, too, when he became the Prophet at 40 years of age, he lived for 40 years. And he didn't, like, just live in his house in Mecca. But he went to the Banu Sa'd, he went to Medina, he went to Sham, he went to all these people. He had business transactions with individuals. And it wasn't that he was an unknown person. He's the grandson of Abdul Muttalib. Like, people know him and his lineage, and nobody from his adversaries to even just like acquaintances could come and say, this man ever did anything dishonest. They couldn't say in any of these interactions, you shouldn't believe he's a prophet because he did this one thing this one time. His honesty just permeated his character, his decisions, his interactions. It's crazy, like, how remarkable this is and how it is manifest in one person, just especially if you deal with people, right? I sit with people all the time who tell me stuff about their life, you know? And there's a lot of, like, terrible human beings in the world, right? May Allah protect us from them and protect us from ever becoming them, do you know? And you got to be wary of these things, because the minute you start to tell yourself that I'm not capable of doing something, that's where shaitan's got you, you know? The Prophet was a sadiq. He was the trustworthy one. Masduq, he was, they believed him. Like, people trusted him, you know? May Allah make us like this. So this is what Abdullah ibn Mas'ud is, before he gets into the text of it. We talked about it briefly last week. If you missed it, you can find it on the podcast. So we want to get into the actual, now, kind of text of the hadith, the matan of the hadith, where the onset is talking about things that are relevant to these characteristics of truthfulness and trustworthiness, because this initial part of the hadith is affirmic Quranic revelation that also speaks about embryology at a time where people don't have any insight on how embryology functions. So the idea is that it's just true because God and His Messenger said it's true. We're going to talk about that in a little bit, but I want us to talk first about other elements of things that go on. And what's happening here beyond the science of it is giving us an understanding of how every single person that comes into existence enters into a worldly sphere of life. Do you know? In order for us to understand this, we got to understand what's happening prior to, as well as what's coming thereafter. So what is happening at 120 days in this hadith? The soul is being breathed into the fetus. Where is the soul before this? Where is it? Huh? With Allah? But where? Like, where is the soul? Yeah. Yeah, right? The abode of the arwah. Like, all the souls, the individual ruh that you have, it didn't come into existence at the moment it's introduced into the fetus, right? It existed prior to, and this is just its introduction into the world. So every soul exists prior to entrance into this world. This is what our theology teaches us, that we are created beings. And so, first phase of existence, if we had a whiteboard here, I would write on it, but I'm not getting up because I'm tired. So think about my table as like the lifespan of your soul, you know? It's great that we have this date and these cups of stuff now because I could use them. So say up until this mic is the existence of your soul prior to entering the womb, the abode of the arwah. This is where your soul is prior to. Every soul is there, right? Alastu bi rabbikum is a Quranic verse. All of the progeny of Adam is gathered together. Am I not your Lord? Allah asks everyone. The verse says, qalu bala shahidna, that yes, we bear witness to this. This is the covenant. Now, you have interactions with people. This is why, like, we're taught, for example, if you just vibe really well with somebody in this world, there's a good chance your souls were close to each other when you're here in the abode of the arwah. Do you know what I mean? If you also do not get along so well, do you guys get along really well? You just gave each other a pound? Yeah, amazing. Great. So if you don't like someone's just annoying to you, which is a thing, You don't have to like everyone to respect them. وَلَكَدْ كَرَمْنَا بَنِي آدَمْ means all of the children of Adam are dignified. I can respect you and still find you to be irritating, right? I don't find any of you irritating. You're all great, mashallah. You don't have to like me to respect me. But by virtue of what we're talking about right now, if you don't really get along with somebody you've never met, and you're like, they're annoying to me. I don't really like them so much. The same way you just click with somebody, and there's a chance your souls were close to each other. You're also in a place where you might have not had that kind of proximity, but there was distance that was there. You just didn't get along so well with somebody. Do you know? So you're going from the abode of the arwah, and now what the hadith is saying is you go from there and you're in the womb. This is a state of existence, the rahim. The hadith uses the word batn, which means belly in Arabic, right? It's the same thing, right? The womb is not in your mother's hand, it's in her stomach. Do you know? So the soul comes into the batn, the rahim. The rahim, it has the same root as rahma, mercy, compassion, right? And this is the idea, right? If you've ever just thought about the way a woman gets pregnant. I don't know if anybody thinks, I don't sit at home and think about how women get pregnant in that way, right? But what's happening when someone gets pregnant? Like their stomach gets bigger, right? So the rahim is giving this illustration that mercy is meant to be expansive, not restrictive. As the fetus grows, so too the womb grows. The rahim as an extension of ar-Rahman, it's giving us this idea that mercy and compassion kind of extends with life. It's not meant to be restrictive. Do you see what I mean? So you're in the womb, right? For however many weeks, months. 9 months is like the general. Some people less, some people more. But the soul is breathed in. That's this interjection into the womb. From this, you have now like a time in dunya. Right, let's say here is dunya, the cup of water. Dunya is going to have phases of existence. None of us in the room right now are babies, right? Are any of you babies? No, you're not, right? All of you exist right now in the materialistic world, okay? If the water is too transparent to see, let's say the date is dunya, okay? Can everybody see what I'm doing here? Or is this camera in the way? Yeah, good. The date is dunya. The starting point is when you're a baby. The end point is when you're an elder. While we are here, there's still souls that are here, right? Because if a baby is born a week from now, it's got the soul in the fetus. If a baby is born a year from now, that fetus doesn't exist abnormally longer than the typical fetus, so that soul is still over here, right? It didn't stop existing, the abode of the arwah, after you were breathed into the fetus, but those souls are still there. The idea is to think bigger than yourself, because there are tons of souls that still haven't come into the womb yet, let alone here. Some people, they're going to get to infancy, and that's going to be the extent of their life in this world. Some people are going to get to being children, adolescents, teenagers, young adults, adulthood, or being like really old. But death is the mechanism of transition from this existence to the next. So you go from here by being blown into here, and then mothers give birth into here, and then death is a means to something. It's not an ends. And what it's a means to is going to be what is this next phase of existence, which is the barzakh, the intermediary realm. This is the grave. May Allah grant us ease in the grave, and grant our loved ones who are in the grave ease. But this is the next phase of existence. It's a place that is impacted by how you live in this world. So for people who did good in this world, their time in the grave is something that's also easy, place of illumination, whatever else. When the soul is removed from the body, that's what's happening. The angel of death is coming. This is what this hadith talks about in terms of fate and decree. So you're not in a state where that pulling is done with ease. There's some challenge there for some, for others. It's a little bit more facilitated. But when everybody is buried, the ground essentially squeezes the person, right? And you're in the grave. People who are good people, they say the grave is a, you know, place where it's restful. The equivalent of like a newlywed couple sleeping on their first night as husband and wife. The rest in the grave is like the way that they would rest, you know? For people who did not live well, it's a place of agitation, a place of difficulty, right? May Allah make it a place of light for us. But this is another phase of existence. We could talk about all these things in detail. We're not going to, because that's not the point of this halakha. But just for us to understand conceptually this hadith, you can't understand it in a vacuum fully, because it's giving us insight into certain things. From the barzakh now, there's resurrection. And you have now a day of judgment. This day of judgment, everybody is there as well. So why it takes so long, right? Because all of us, think about how many people in New York City there are right now on the street. This is like an iota of the number of people that exist. So why is the Day of Judgment so long? Because there's so many people. And everybody is taken into account for everything. Like all of the stuff that they have. All of the stuff that they did. All of the stuff that they didn't do, but they could have done. Like all of it is in the prism of judgment. So this is going to be where people are resurrected from their graves. And they are resurrected on the Day of Judgment. The Day of Judgment is just that. It's a day of judgment. There's nothing else that it is. You are judged based off of your actions in this world. Right? And then from there, you have the rest of the table until that wall, as far as you can go. That's eternal existence. We are created beings, but we were made for eternal existence. So you want to visualize as best as you can, right? How much is this in comparison to everything else? It's nothing in comparison to everything else. But the trick that we fall into is not only is it unnecessarily magnified, it's seen as the only thing. This is just a drop in the bucket in terms of what eternal existence means. So don't live just for this. And understand how it's related to everything that comes prior to and after the fact. If we were to start adopting characteristics now relevant to the frames of existence that our souls go through, the abode of the arwah, this is where you are in the beginning. It's your creating point. The Rahim, it's an abode of mercy. The first place Allah puts you before you leave from the place of the souls is a home of mercy, the Rahim. He's looking for reasons for you to succeed. You are in dunya for a little bit of time. Dunya is the place of decision-making and actions. You cannot act in the womb. You cannot take actions in the abode of the arwah. You can only act and choose choices in dunya. You get into the barzakh, the intermediary realm. You can't do anything there. It's a place of rest, a place of slumber. Look at how exhausting the world is, right? May Allah grant us ease. فَإِذَا فَرَغْتَ فَانْسَبْ, as the Qur'an says, right? That after you have exhausted yourself, like then you like put in the work, you know what I mean? Right? You want to get to a place where it's a place of actual restful slumber based off of what's happening here. But that's what this is. It's a place of rest. Like you can't do anything there. The place that you can do stuff is here in the dunya. You cannot do anything after you leave dunya. no more choices, no more actions. The people in dunya can do for you. That's why we are described as one of the things that benefits the deceased after they leave. Knowledge that they pass on, an ongoing charity, and a believing child that prays for them, right? So you have impact on what happens thereafter for yourself as well as for others. None of you play for my great-grandparents. That doesn't mean you're bad people. But why in your consciousness would you be thinking about my ancestors? There's only certain people's names that you know that exist. If you're not making dua for them, who's making dua for them? And if you don't have a reason to get up to pray for yourself, you're not getting up to pray for the people that struggled for you and sacrificed for you, so you could be sitting with a multi-million dollar view in the middle of Manhattan. Like, that's what it is. You get to the Day of Judgment. The Day of Judgment is about accountability. Also not a place where you can take actions. So you can't say to Allah, let me go back and pray a couple of extra rak'ahs that I missed. Let me go give that charity that I should have given. Let me go seek forgiveness from the one that I wronged. Let me go apologize for the lies that I told, the gossiping that I engaged in. Let me go try to fix the messes that I make or engage in acts of kindness and beauty. Just give me a little bit more time. There's people who are going to come on the Day of Judgment. Forget about having books that are filled with all kinds of challenging things or whatever else. The angels are going to come to them and their books are going to have nothing in it. And they're going to say to them, how long did you live in this world? And in that moment, they're going to be like looking in their books and saying, maybe a day, maybe half a day, because they did nothing. It wasn't even that they did wrong or right in a lit. They did nothing with their time. There's nothing written in the book. And then you can't do anything when you're on the Day of Judgment. That's just when you're taken into account for what you did. It's not the place of doing. The place of doing is here, where we're at right now. And then after that is eternal existence. May Allah make us people of Jannah. The whole idea when you are here is to not live in pursuit of Jannah or to live in avoidance of Jahannam. The whole idea when you're here is to just live in pursuit of the pleasure of the divine. And then Allah in His infinite wisdom is going to decide where we end up. But if you live for Jannah or you live in avoidance of Jahannam, that's not the same as living to build a relationship with the creator of Jannah and Jahannam, which can do nothing to you other than what Allah wills for it to do. So I want you to think for a minute as we're looking at this hadith about its relevance to us, because we'll talk about it in terms of the fiqh of abortion and like medicinal practices and whatever else. But for all of us, we got to understand this foundational part. You are not the body that exists in this worldly existence. You are the soul that was breathed into the womb, that came from the abode of the souls, that is now traversing this worldly plane with this vessel that is physical, that is going to return back to the earth that it came from, and then the movement forward is going to continue to be of the souls. So here is where we want to think that Allah took us in our celestial state and breathed us, we have been breathed into the womb in a physical state. So there's a relationship now between what is physical and metaphysical at the very onset of our creation, where we now have movement forward. What do we do with these souls that we have? How much of the day, the week? All of you are created from a common beginning. You go 40 days here to 40 days here to 40 days here, and then the soul comes in. That's you. You're the soul. You're not the lump of flesh alone that is cultivated in the womb. And then you move forward now in this existence, having a worldly experience as a celestially created entity. Where does it get lost in the mix? the focus now that is purely on the physical rather than the metaphysical. And it's not an either or, but it's a both and. The hadith is telling us through the prism of embryology, you have parts that are physical and you have parts that are metaphysical. What gets in the way of recognizing the synergy as well as the individual understanding of the presence of the ruh that is there? That all of us are made in this way, but all of us don't necessarily remember it. Does this make sense? So I'd like you to do, I'll take a pause. You turn to the persons next to you. What are you taking away from this so far? What is it bringing up for you in the course of this conversation? Some of the takeaways, and then we'll come back and discuss and kind of move forward. But go ahead.
Shift have to head off to the hospital.
All right, man. Thank you. Have a good night.
Yeah. There's like, I don't know what is the year there from the scholars, because there's like three books about just this word missing. You need to take a lot of things to and if you count like
okay, so what are some of the things we're discussing? What's coming up for people? Yeah, go ahead, Rilla.
I was thinking like how we're just so focused in the materialistic things in the world. I wouldn't specifically call like education and career as materialistic, but still it is materialistic because it takes away the thought of like why we're brought into this world and like the purpose that we are in this world, which is to serve humanity and do good to other people. For example, we were just discussing how it took something really horrible in Gaza for us to wake up like 42 days ago. But because we were so focused in our materialistic values, being an education, career, or other things, that we didn't pay attention to what's happening in other parts of the world. And it's 75 years of occupation, not just 42 days. Because we're so focused in like materialistic things in the world, we forget about the soul and the purpose of being.
But how do you forget about, like, it's a part of you? Do you get what I mean? Like, if you don't think about the little pinky toe on your foot, it doesn't mean you're not utilizing it or it's not there. Do you get what I'm saying? Like, parts of it, like, I was talking to my kids the other day, and I was trying to convince my children to let me shave their eyebrows off of their face. And they said, well, Baba, no. And I was like, what do you even use them for? When do you ever think about them? And they're like, no, Baba, like, you shave your eyebrows. And I'm like, no. Like, I'm not going to. I'm going to shave yours off. But, like, there's parts of you that just because you don't think about them doesn't mean that they're not, like, still present or that you wouldn't do anything to, like, let them go, right? Like, what do you use, like, all of the toes on your feet for? But if I said I'll give you $1,000 to give me one of your pinky toes, none of you would do it, you know? The nails on your feet, what do you use them for? Do you know what I mean? Right? Realistically speaking, there's things that you don't even know why they're there. But the idea that I would let go of any part of my physical self is, like, how is that even possible? If you're not engaging your ruh, it doesn't mean that it's not a part of you still. Right? It's the very thing that's like the essential life component. The ruh is not something Quranically that we're given so much detail on. Do you get what I mean? But it is the distinguishing variable between the body that has life and the body that has no life. Because when you move from dunya to barzakh, the material world, to the intermediary realm, death is the process of what? The soul being removed from the body. So, if this thing is so important, why is it not being paid attention to? Do you know what I mean? And the way that I'm built is not necessarily that, yeah, like, even if I'm not thinking about the toes on my feet, if I didn't have any of them, my balance would get thrown off. The way that I walk would get screwed up. Do you know what I mean? But can you actually live in the world just as a physical body. And yeah, like you can live in a world that even though the ruh is there, you are not engaging it or taking care of it or cultivating it in any capacity. The nafs can be what defines decisions. The heart doesn't have to. And so you get to a place where what I eat is just about the physicality. How I dress is just about the physicality. How I sleep is just about the physicality. Whether I pray or not is just about the physical, the relationships that I have or I don't have. All of these things is just about what is outward, what is outward, what is outward. This is what we talk about quite often. Praying with your body versus praying with your heart. Praying versus praying to God, right? And what are you praying to God with? It's not just the presence of your physical body, but all of these things aligned in the ways that they need to be aligned, you know? So can you have just a purely physical living in this world without engaging the metaphysical? Like, yeah, you could live overtly just as a body, as if you didn't have this soul inside of you. Do you get what I mean? Does this make sense? Other thoughts? What else came up for people as we were talking? Yeah. Yeah, that's why the hadith on intentions is the first hadith in the book. Do you know? You don't like memorize hadith just at random, but you also see there's an order to why they're placing these things in the chapters that they do and why certain chapters precede other chapters. You're on a journey, like as a spirit. It's going to eternal existence. So intentionality can have multiplicity to it. But a part of it has to also be in a place where, like, hey, like, there's a destination ahead that's an ultimate destination. And all the stuff is going to get left behind. Do you know what I mean? I'm not taking my jacket with me to the Day of Judgment. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not. Do you know? It's got a utility to it. Functionally, it's something that's there. And where and how you're in certain places that, like, if you fundamentally just get everything you want in the world, then what do you need Jannah for? But the roadway to get the ruh back to where it came from, so where the Quran speaks about the warithun, right? The inheritors. What are they? They're the inheritors of Jannah. May Allah make us from amongst them. Like the whole idea is you're trying to go back home, like where you came from. Do you know? Right? So the roadblocks that are going to come in the way are going to be the nature of this, of what we know of it, is sometimes about denial of the things that make it just a bodily experience. Because the nafs is lazy, and it's not generous, and it's not charitable, and it doesn't want you to apologize. It doesn't want you to struggle. Do you know what I mean? So sometimes you got to push and not formulate against things that are rooted in what the first part of the hadith is saying, right? Who is sadiq wal masduq, that he is the trustworthy one and the one that is trusted. And he's a representative of the divine. And that whatever this book says, even if it's talking about embryology 14 centuries ago, you don't have to understand it in order for it to be true. It doesn't need for you to believe it in order for it to be valid. But it's in your benefit to actually believe it. Not what you think is best, what Allah thinks is best. And what does your spirit have to say about it? Not just your body. What does your metaphysical have to say about it? Not just the physical. Does it make sense? Yeah. Other thoughts? What else is coming up for people as we discuss some of this? What did you talk about? Yeah.
Decision for for like a short-term pleasure, it's good to have the context and framework of is it worth the pain in the afterlife for the short-term pleasure in the world?
Yeah, Ali radiallahu an, right, the cousin of the Prophet alayhi salam, he says, right, your souls, they're worth only the price of paradise. So sell them only for that price. Do you know? Right? Like, don't sell the most important treasure that's within you for some paltry sum of dunya. You can't even take it with you. You know what I mean? You can't. This is what people try to do historically. Not only did people bury all their stuff with them, they tried to bury their people with them also. Servants, spouses, etc. What ended up happening? A bunch of white people looted them and took from their tombs and put in museums in their own countries. So the people in their own countries still don't get to have their stuff, right? You go all over Europe. You go all over the United States. There's a bunch of things that we just took from other people that didn't belong to us. But they didn't take it either then. If it's sitting in the museum, it didn't get with them to the barzakh, right? Like, what is there with them? Which is where the hadith ends. It talks about actions and deeds. That's the only thing you're taking with you. Deeds, actions, what you did, what you prevented yourself from doing, versus what you could have done, but you still didn't do it. And if there's not a focal point that says that this little part of existence that's dunya cannot be like the ends, but I see it as a means to something, then the paradigm through which you engage worldly existence is going to be quite limited if it's only seen as what are the potentials here. Because struggle here translates into increase there. And struggle here is temporary, increase there is forever. So it's not worth it to me that you and I, we're going to hang out till 3 o'clock in the morning if that means that I'm going to sleep through Fajr. Because missing Fajr is something that's, for my soul, a deterrent towards vision of what is coming forward. Do you get what I mean? What I'd like you to do for just a few minutes is turn to the persons next to you and don't have like a right or wrong conversation. Don't speak only if you feel like you're saying what's most correct, but let yourself just deepen and explore into the actual discussion. How do you take care of your ruh? Like you specifically, how does one take care of it? And what are things that are like damaging the ruh? Or your metaphysical state, right? Your heart, your soul, like the combination of these things. What are the things that are good for it? What are the things that are not good for it? How does one take care of it? If my 8-year-old was here today and was like, hey man, like, I don't know what my dad's talking about. He's trying to get me to shave my eyebrows off my face, right? What kind of man do I live with in my house, you know? Can you tell me what this thing is, this soul, and how do I take care of it, right? And if all you get when you're at a younger stage of life is also all you get when you engage religion, and it's just the do's and don'ts and the mechanics, the postures of prayer, the recitation of Quran, the how-tos of fasting, they're still only limited to the externals, right? It doesn't mean that there's not a relationship there. The hadith is teaching us about the onset of a synergy between physical and metaphysical. So you got to start to delve into, how does this metaphysical work? What do I do? Not like theoretically, but what are things one can do to take care of their inner self? Does the question make sense? So in the course of my day, my week, my month, like what are things that are going to bring that kind of luminosity inwardly that's going to provide care to my inner self? We can talk about this for a few minutes, then we'll come back and discuss. Go ahead.
I'm
Okay. So, what are some of the ways, like, how does somebody take care of their inner self? The physical, the metaphysical has this connection. We live in a world that teaches us to look at ourselves and not for ourselves, right? And quite often, the identity variables that we have are attached now to things that are just outward and external alone. So how do we start to shift to seeing the importance of both of these spheres as it permeates every part of our religious tradition? Do you know? Like bringing presence to our inner components of prayer, of charity, of fasting, of pilgrimage, you know, being able to connect at the level of spirits and souls, right? So we're not just sharing sociological characteristics, common culture, common race, common ethnicity, but we're connected at the level of hearts, like inwardly. So what can one do to take care of their inner self? What do we talk about? Yeah.
So I mentioned that I follow a halakha yesterday that spoke about how Musa alayhi salam wanted to meet Allah in those 40 days. And one thing, he was fasting during 30 days, and then he added 10 more. And the person who spoke said that being in the state of fasting helped him elevate from the literally like the weight of food. Not having that helped him elevate himself to like having to speak with Allah. So I guess fasting is a way to like purify your soul, but also engaging in Quran, in the sunnahs that Rasulullah used to engage to. And one of them is read Surah Al-Mulk before going to sleep, which is, you mentioned Barzakh, and it's one of the surahs that can prevent you from being tortured there. So that, and praying more sunnahs, and like engaging with your religion, not just in the fard, but also in the sunnahs.
Yeah, amazing. Like, think about, for many of us, what life is like in Ramadan versus outside of Ramadan. But conceptually, what's going on there? You know, what's being lifted in terms of veils of perception through not just like the emptying of a stomach, but the filling of a heart, right? So you're nourishing other parts of yourself and cultivating a relationship with those things. And these exercises, again, don't need our presence to help, you know? So somebody can become physically strong by working as like a woodsman their whole life. They're not purposely going to a gym for an hour, but they're chopping wood and they're carrying wood and they're selling wood and moving wood. It's going to make them hard in their like muscles and whatever else, do you know? Like it brings that fortitude and toughness. Do you get what I mean? Right? So if you said to someone like, hey, do you exercise? They'd be like, no, I don't exercise, right? But they're not saying, I chop wood for 8 hours a day. You know what I mean? It's the same way. You can experience like the practice in Ramadan. It doesn't mean you have to be consciously aware of what it's doing or understand in order to gain from it, do you know? As well as these other practices that are there, right? But if you bring presence to it, it then now affords the question, why would you stop after it's done? Like, why did you stop reading Quran when Ramadan was done? Why did you stop fasting when Ramadan was done? Why did you stop giving in charity? Why did you stop coming to pray together in congregation? Do you know what I mean? It's not to knock anybody, but to ask those questions. What's the trade-off, especially in relation to what we're talking about here? What else? Like, what else are things we discussed? Yeah.
I think conscientious about what you consume and not just through dietary means, but also what you listen to and what you view. So, like, an example for me, I was really bad with reality TV. And then I've given that up, alhamdulillah. But it's important to replace that with something good for your soul, too. So, like, listening to a religious podcast, it could be anything. So that's been really helpful.
Amazing. Yeah, consumption. Go ahead. Great. Reflection is really important, right? Imam al-Haddad, rahmallah, he says that reflection is the lamp of the heart. When it departs from it, there's no light in it. Do you know? What else? Yeah.
I think being at peace and being satisfied and grateful for what you have, especially in the age of social media where there's a lot being thrown at us in terms of like the influence. So just being grateful for like the bare minimum, which I think we are in like the recent times because we have seen other people suffer through it. Like clean water, shelter, and food, which other people don't have. So just being grateful for like the basic necessities of life and having tawakkul.
Yeah, 100%, right? And in the reflection periods, you ask the question of how much is enough? Like, how much do I need? Do you know? And it all becomes attached to each other. Can we understand the connection between the physical and the metaphysical? You know, you don't exist in two places simultaneously. Or when you go home at night, you don't like unzip your body off of your soul and then hang it up in the closet. But there's a connection point in terms of worldly existence between these two things. They coexist simultaneously. Do you get what I mean? Does that make sense? So why don't we do it? Like, what gets in the way? What's like the barrier of kind of engagement of both facets? Because it's not either or, right? We're not a people who are just meant to read Quran all day to the detriment of worldly responsibilities and physical nature, right? Like, there's hadith where the Prophet essentially speaks about dislike for the portly scholar, you know? Like, how can you be an alim of Islam, like a scholar of Islam, and, you know, be portly? It's not like your physical body is what's being questioned here, but somebody who is purposefully, like, eating to a point of satiation, not taking care of their physical wellness, and they claim knowledge of the religion. Do you see what I mean? Like, the body is the vessel of the soul, so it has to be something that you are honoring as well through your recognition of how you kind of traverse this worldly plane. Do you know? Yeah. Yeah, and there's multiple answers, yeah. Right? And they're going to be individualized, do you know? But in thinking about this again in this way, what kind of experience am I having right now in this world? And am I having just simply like a bodily experience, a physical experience? Am I also having a metaphysical experience? Do you know what I mean? And what are the things that engage the different parts of what make me what I am? And how are the two things connected to each other? So the hadith is giving us indication to the remarkable nature of scientific kind of insight from the Quran and the hadith at times when people did not think about these things. But its individual relevancy back to me is that, hey, like all of us as humans, we're made in this way in our worldly existence. There's the physical body, and then there's the soul breathed in at 120 days of the fetus existence. So why is this hadith mentioning this thing? And it's not just in terms of when does like life begin and theological debates and what does abortion mean and when is it allowed and when is it not, but it's also telling me what are the foundational building blocks of me as a person. Does anywhere in the Quran or the hadith say when you hit a certain age, your soul departs but your body still moves? No, right? Like, you are in this place where these things necessitate coexistence in order for the body to actually have life to it. And if at any point in time the soul is removed from the body is just a shell. So it's not the primary, and this is where the shift comes in, that the focus only becomes on the primary being the body. But it's not. It's a part of it, but it's not the whole thing. And if anything, what's moving forward is going to be the ruh, not the jasad, not the badan. So why am I spending so much time fussing over just what is external alone, let alone even thinking about how it relates? And all these other things that are heightened in terms of just inward self-development, you know, and thinking about what else exists within me. It's not just the qalb and the ruh and the akal, but inside of you are all of your memories, all of the experiences you've had, all of the feelings that you have, right? Do you feel better when you're sad alone or when you're sad with somebody else who's there to support you when you're sad? Do you feel a little bit better when you let out certain things rather than holding them all inside of you? You start to learn about the nature of the self through the self. And you start to think too also, what does it mean to be a supporter of somebody else? Right? Anybody can pontificate to people, do you know? But the Prophet ﷺ didn't talk so much. So what was he bringing out with people? He was helping them to recognize what they had as inward beauty. Even the man who's narrating the hadith, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, is a young black man who's poor, who is physically skinny and small in stature. People would laugh at him, right? We said this hadith last time, that he was climbing, getting something from a tree, and the wind blew, and it lifted up his garment so you could see his legs. And people were laughing at his legs, at how skinny they were. And the Prophet asked them, like, what are you laughing at? And they say, we're laughing at his legs, right? Because they're so skinny. And the Prophet says that his legs are going to weigh heavier on the scales on the Day of Judgment than the mountains of Uhud, you know? Like, there's a recognition that what ennobles him is not what worldly, societally perspective is ennobling. So who cares if Meccan society is treating poor people a certain way, black people a certain way, etc. Not in the way that we're indifferent towards it, but this man's elevation is coming from the fact that he is just inwardly strong, and all of those things are what make him good and beautiful, not because society is the judge of what's good and beautiful, but Allah in His wisdom. This is what the hadith is. Allah in His wisdom is decreeing certain things for us. Do you see what I mean? So the way that you were built is that you have the physical and then you have the metaphysical. And those two things have to be understood. The dunya is going to make you think only about the physical, even in relation to your feelings that are inward and expressed outward. It's going to teach you to only engage what you feel through external mechanisms. Numb the pain, desensitize the pain, be in a place where outward mechanisms help you deal with inward agitation. Smoke this, drink this, watch this, consume this, listen to this, wear this, dress like this, eat this, drink this. But it's just temporary, it's band-aids, right? Because to apply something physical to something metaphysical that's hurting, it's not gonna, can you put a band-aid on your soul? Do you know what I mean? Right? Can I put a band-aid on my spiritual heart? No. You gotta look for things that are also metaphysical in their nature that allow for there to be a sense of holistically who it is that we are. So you can read this hadith and be in awe that the Prophet, expounding upon Quranic verse, is talking to us about the stages of embryology and the growth of the fetus. It's remarkable. Do you know what I mean? And that's not something we should undermine. But we don't want that to be the only takeaway. And at this juncture in our collective lives, individually, you got to be in a place where you have recognition of the phases of existence in a way that's not just rotely memorized, but it informs decisions. It plays a role in determining choices. Because where this hadith is going to end, that we'll talk about next time, is going to be about actions and deeds, right? You can live a life that's the life of the people of paradise. And at the end of it, it's turned away, right? Same thing. The opposite is true. Because it's all about actions and deeds. How many actions do you undertake for the sake of what is outward and what is physical versus how many are you undertaking for the sake of what is inward and what is metaphysical? Do you get what I mean? Does that make sense? And then the trick is when you can get the inside right, the outside looks so different. So you don't want to just find beauty in everyone around you, but you learn to find beauty in yourself. It's not just about having love for others, but you also understand the biggest block to loving others is that you don't love yourself fully. And what you need to be able to love yourself fully is a removal of the things that are layered now on the inner self, not on the outer self. Outwardly, we all look the way we look. That's why some of these things are invisible, but they're still present. Like, people don't pay attention to you when you're sad. They're not stopping on the street saying, like, are you okay when you're feeling miserable? Entire experiences are erased, you know? Because they're only looking at you from physical eyes, not metaphysical eyes. There's so many hadith where the companions are looking agitated, and the Prophet, even before they ask something, he's like, what's on your minds? Because he knows what his people are going through. He's connected at a different level. Do you know what I mean? So it's not just like anxiety that's telling me, I need to talk to you right now. Like, tell me what's bothering you. But love. And it just comes across different. Do you know? But you can't give somebody something you don't possess in the first place. And you can only give to them what you do have in the first place. So what, like, if we opened up your heart right now, your spiritual heart, what would we find inside of it? In terms of virtue, in terms of vices, in terms of things that are values and things of beauty and things that are like diseases of the heart, right? It's not like a thing that we have. Like, everybody makes mistakes. And there's stuff that's inside of us that we didn't put inside of us, but it's still there. So at some juncture, I like just figure out what are the building blocks of me and think out, okay, like, well, maybe some of this sits there because I'm not actually looking at this through the prism of this part of me is actually an important part of me that existed well before the physical part of me existed and is going to continue to exist after this entire world and everything in it is gone, right? That soul, like, still exists. You're created as a being, but you're created for eternal existence. Does that make sense? Do you get what I mean? Right? And what does it look like there? Like, I don't know, you know, like, we're in our prime state of existence when we're in Jannah. May Allah make us people of Jannah. I told this to people last year, but there's a brother who's a convert in our community. They say you're like 33, 35 years old in Jannah, right? Lunar years, you know? And he had just turned that age. And he was like, man, I got to lose a lot of weight. I was like, why do you got to lose a lot of weight? He's like, because I don't want to be fat in Jannah. And I said, what are you talking about? He's like, well, aren't you going to be who you are when you're 33 in Jannah? And I was like, no, that's not what it means. Like, it's not like the state that you're in. It's just talking about primacy, like when you're like kind of at your best. And he was like, great, because I'm like fat right now. And I don't want to be fat forever. I was like, hey, man, Allah make us all people. I would rather be a fat man in heaven than like a well put together man in hell. you know? And that's what you gotta really think about, right? Like fundamentally, this is what you have to think about, do you know? How much of dunya is going to be enough to give up, like, bliss in akhirah? So why? Why are you giving in to emotional angst that validates you talking to people poorly, that makes it seem like it's okay to gossip about someone? These are stupid reasons to bring, like, detriment to you in the world beyond this one. Do you know what I mean? It's, like, dumb. Do you know? Not that, like, any haram makes sense to do in that sense. And a lot of people turn to haram in the absence of community support and people, like, giving to them, which are other things you want to think about. We all have a common beginning. If you don't value your spirit, you're definitely not going to value somebody else's spirit. And then you can only connect at the level of a shared external. It's not a sign of strength, necessarily, that the only people you're ever comfortable around are the people that are from the same village of the same country that your family came from. And you get thrown into a conundrum the minute you're around people that are different from you. Or that you have to debase people that come from different walks of life, claim that they're lacking in comparison to you, is telling you something about the state of your inside. It's not strong, it's weak, insecure, fragile at that point in time. Do you know? Okay, so let's do this. We'll take a pause here. People want to take a quick few minutes and just turn to the people next to you. What are you taking away from the overall conversation? Just for 2-3 minutes, and we'll come back and discuss. My mom is calling me, so that's why we're going to pause right now. Then we'll come back and discuss. Assalamu alaikum. Haan, maa ji, koshish ki thi ek do dafa, par nahi mila. Kya haal hai? Acha, main bhool gaya tha, maa ji. हां वो अभी रोक रोक उनको कह दें कि अभी नहीं दें मैं थोड़े दिन में बता दूंगा अगर इजाजत मिलेगी जो भी है अभी मैं ये जरा एक दर्श करवा रहा हूं इस्लामिक सेंटर पे ये हलका हो रहा है अभी मीडियम स्मॉल मीडियम ऐसे हाँ मीडियम ठीक है मैं आपको फिर कल फ़ोन करूँगा मुझे तो काम हो रहा है थोड़ा तो मैं इधर ये पता है दोपहर के वक्त करूँगा क्या हाँ अच्छा ओहो अपने यहाँ चले आप करें मैं कल कर लूँगा फिर अच्छा कुछ भी मैं कल आपको कर लूँगा फिर बात करते हैं सॉरी Okay, so just as we're wrapping up, what are some of the takeaways from the conversation overall? Anything coming up for people or standing out? Yeah.
I think the end of the last portion of the hadith, I think I see that, of course, prayer is our guard. You know, prayer is our guard from reaching Jahannam or hellfire. With as well where it is our obligation to continue to learn more of the deen, making that connection, especially with, you know, for me, about arwah as well, you know, the soul, and making that connection between the physical self and metaphysical self and the ruh, you know, just to acknowledge that and help individually acknowledge that and help brothers and sisters, even at younger age, as you mentioned, this is your son, subhanAllah, for them to acknowledge that and give them that spiritual growth is very important.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Other thoughts, other things we're taking away? Because that's what we're sanctifying, right? When we're sanctifying human life, when people put conditions on, we will only sanctify people of this skin color, people of this complexion, people of this country, people of this background, they're failing to recognize we all have like this shared humanity that's rooted in this experience of having these spirits, do you know? And there's a dignity that's shared within this experientially. But if you don't ever think about those parts of yourself, you're not then thinking about these parts within other people or honoring them through those ways or recognizing it through that. Do you see? Okay, so let's do this. We'll take a pause here. Just a quick reminder, Dr. Ali Mermer will have his halakha tomorrow, Tuesday. The building closes tomorrow at 8 p.m. And then it's going to be closed Wednesday and Thursday. We're going to be open for Jummah on Friday. The building will be open from 12 to 4. We'll have lunch after. We'll pray Asr, probably around like 3, 3:30, and then ask people to kind of head out of the space. It'll close before Maghrib time, so just keep that in mind. And if anyone's around on Friday, it's just going to be Khalid and I, like, here from our staff. So if you can come, help set up, help clean up, we'd appreciate it. And also just be in the space. Typically on holidays, we get as many people as we do during the rest of the, year. Because different people show up also. People are off from school, so they'll bring their children. Families will come. People who are visiting the city, they've heard about the IC. Like, they'll come for Jummah. So it'd be amazing that when they come, they have a great experience if it's like one of their only times coming. So as many of us can be around to help and welcome people in, that would be great. And then after that, the building will be closed through the weekend and resume on Monday its normal hours of operation. We have registration open for our Umrah trip. I know some of you are going to be joining us. The rest of you are interested, or you know people who will be interested. We're going to go from January 3rd to the 12th. We do 4 days in Medina and then 4 days in Mecca. You should definitely try to come. This year, we're trying to keep it a little smaller than previous years. Last year, we took 200 people, which is really nice, mashallah. But everyone didn't get to meet everyone else. So I think we're limiting it to 80 people or so for this year. Just so we can kind of create more of that cohesion in the group, which means also we're not like unlimited in seats. So if you can apply sooner than later or tell people that you know who might be interested to apply, just so we can kind of get it squared away. We do a lot of prep sessions in advance. There's a lot of guided tours that we do. We do halakas after Fajr, after Isha. It's a little different from like what other Umrah experiences are like. So I recommend coming if you can, or letting people know to join as well. And then next week we'll have all of our normal programs that we normally do, plus some one-off programs that we're doing. We're going to be starting again with our professional groups meeting. So we have a meetup planned in the first week of December. I think we have something planned for the IC professionals group. We're going to have a Black Muslim meetup in addition to our monthly Latino Muslim meetup. We're going to do a dinner for our convert community. So there'll be different things happening that you could definitely avail yourselves of. And we'll be advertising all of that in the coming week as well, inshallah. So we prayed Isha before we started, just so people know. If you could help, just put the chairs back, and we'll see everyone next Monday, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum. So it's a lot.